Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Saudi Arabia's threat to sell off up to $750 billion in treasury notes and other U.S. assets before any possibility of freezing these assets by American courts could arise if a bill in Congress that would strip Saudi Arabia's sovereign immunity proceeds, thus opening the door for lawsuits by the families of victims of 9/11. Former CIA officer Robert Baer joins us. He was among the first to expose the perfidious relationship between Saudi Arabia and the U.S. in his book Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And ahead of President Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia on Wednesday, we will discuss the building pressure to declassify 28 pages of a 2002 joint congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks that expose a Saudi role, which, if released to the public, would likely give impetus to the bill and the lawsuits by the 9/11 families. Then we'll look into the growing animus between supporters of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton that could derail the chances of the Democrats winning the presidency and taking back the Senate in spite of disarray and division on the Republican side. Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, who attended last Thursday's debate in Brooklyn between the two Democratic primary candidates, joins us to discuss how the tension on the stage was nothing compared to the friction in the crowd, and how this tribal fratricide could prove fatal for the Democrats, as it did in 1968 and 1980. Then finally, with today's impeachment vote against Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff proceeding in the lower house of Congress in Brasilia, we'll examine the consequences of a likely impeachment in a bitterly divided country whose economy is in free fall as the Zika virus spreads at an alarming rate, all casting a shadow over the Olympics, which are to be held in South America's largest nation less than 4 months from now. Peter Hakim, President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue, joins us to discuss this impending crisis from which everyone except the judiciary will emerge as losers. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He's considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
It's great to be back.
And President Obama is off to Saudi Arabia on Wednesday for meetings, the scope of which I'm not entirely clear on. But what is interesting is what's happening in the Senate with a bipartisan group of senators led by Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, and Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, who have put together a coalition of unlikely liberals and conservatives together, like Al Franken and Ted Cruz, in a bill that would strip Saudi Arabia of sovereignty if these 28 pages you and I were involved with back several months ago at UCLA with a forum that we did with Senator Bob Graham, the former chairman of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, who was also the co-chairman of the Joint Congressional Inquiry into 9/11, these 28 pages were the subject of a 60 Minutes expose last Sunday. And it looks like they've motivated the Senate to basically pass a narrowly crafted law that if these 28 pages revealed what most people think is in them, as much as people can tell us about what they have seen in these classified pages, seems to have given this bill impetus. And, of course, if the bill were to be passed, then the families who are suing the Saudi Arabia for 9/11, the victims, the families of the victims, the door would be open to them. Now, I'm sorry about this long introduction, but the Saudis have preemptively threatened to cash in $750 billion worth of treasuries before they get frozen in if such a situation were to arise. So walking us through that, let's begin with the 28 pages. Do you think that the 60 Minutes piece and the work that Senator Bob Graham's been doing are starting to bear fruit?
Oh, I think absolutely. We pretty well know what's in the 28 pages, which ties Saudi officials to the 9/11 hijackers, guys in San Diego, a couple of them in Florida. And under our laws, and at least the RICO Act, these Saudi officials are indictable for 9/11. They provided direct support, material support to terrorism. You know, we have a bunch of laws that we could indict these guys on. And if you then throw in a civil suit against the Saudi government, which I think could be won in a court, the Saudis should be worried that they're going to get their assets taken away. I don't know that it's $750 billion. I don't think anybody knows exactly how much money they put into this country, but they have for years. I mean, we have to remember that when it comes to the United States, Saudi Arabia is the pusher. It gives us easy money, cheap oil. We've never cared to look into this country. And all of a sudden, this has started to turn. I mean, I think it's the wars in the Middle East, the fact that their form of Islam, Wahhabi Islam, is driving the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. And even in Yemen, where they are fighting Al-Qaeda, still a Wahhabi version of Islam is driving it. So, yeah, I think it's just absolutely amazing, the times. And now you have the Iranian army itself deploying to Syria. It was just the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And now it's the army, and you've got Hezbollah fighting there. And it looks to the Saudis, and particularly the Saudi royal family, that we are backing away from them very quickly. The nuclear agreement with Iran, Iran's disrupting the oil meeting in Doha today because it's not participating. It says it's going to up its production to more than 4 million barrels. I mean, our strategic weight in the Middle East is quickly shifting. I don't think it's been planned that way, but that's what's happening, and that's the way the Saudis look at it. And if this bill passes, we're on uncharted waters.
So do you think that President Obama is going to Riyadh on Wednesday to reassure the Saudi Arabians? He has tried to block the bill and discourage it. Secretary Kerry testified against it, saying that it could backfire by removing sovereign immunity of the Saudis. The reverse could happen to the United States, and U.S. citizens could be arrested around the world. My understanding is that this bill is narrowly crafted to only involve those attacks on American soil. So the key then would be, do these 28 pages pin the Saudi Arabian government, the royal family, to these attacks, or lower-level officials? Do we know what the chain of command is in terms of Saudi involvement?
Well, I think the ambassador, at least his wife, is implicated in this because she sent money to the two San Diego hijackers. That's been very well reported in the press and reliably reported. Now, what the royal family knew about 9/11 in advance is anybody's guess. We certainly don't know, and they're certainly not going to talk. And even me, who's not particularly pro-Saudi, would find it difficult that the family sat down and said, let's attack the United States. The problem has always been that there's been princes, and of course, the clerics, the Wahhabi clerics, the al-Sheikh family, have really, truly dislike Western civilization. I mean, they think it's a threat to them. And they are perfectly capable of doing that, and they've created the ideology. And yes, this bill is narrow, but the point, it opens the floodgates to go after the Saudis. And, you know, where does it stop? And if I were Obama, I would be worried about this strategic relationship becoming unstitched. Yemen is not going well for Saudi Arabia. You've got the country controlled by a man 30 years old with little to no experience, resented inside the family and among Saudis. Huge disparity in wealth. And the president, has even admitted himself he hasn't done well on his legacy in the Middle East. I mean, there's nothing close to, getting the Israelis moving toward any sort of settlement, and you've got Libya lost, and you've got the Islamic State is under threat, but it's simply migrated to different parts of the Middle East. So I think he's not going to be the one to put a nail in this coffin of our relations with Saudi Arabia. So I think he will go reassure them, and he has not hurried to declassify those 28 pages, and he could very easily.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished CIA agents in CIA history, the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal, and the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including Sleeping with the Devil, Our Washington Soul, Our Soul for Saudi Crude. He is now the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, and his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws of Assassination. So given this constellation of events seeming to align against Saudi Arabia, my feeling is that it's just finally there's some honesty emerging about this sort of sick relationship that the royal family has with the Wahhabi clerics, and the fact that I think it's just unimpeachably clear that the Wahhabi version of Islam has spread around the world and radicalized Islam. And I guess the real question would be, in terms of those 28 pages, is for most people, it's hard for them to get their heads around the idea of why a country, either officially or unofficially, either from the top or from various elements within the ruling family, would attack the United States. The logic of it escapes reason. Can you sort of give us some insight?
Well, I don't think it escapes reason. This is a very anxious society. Wahhabi Islam rose under the threat, tribal threat and chaos in the desert, and the dissolving of the Ottoman Empire. It rose under conflict, and I think for us, what we have to look at and is Palmyra, the fact that the Islamic State, driven by Wahhabi ideology, goes in and destroys a Roman city. I mean, this is a mentality that few of us can understand, this iconoclasm, and the fact that they believe that Islam is in a a cataclysmic struggle with the West, and if Islam fails, they will fail entirely. And these people believe that they're existential. I mean, they're under existential threat, and that's what's so difficult for us to understand, because we're not, and we don't tend to overreact. So you have to look at the Sunnis, and especially the Hanafi school, which is the Wahhabis, are encircled. They're encircled. They believe in Yemen with a reemerging Iran, which has an empire between Iraq and Syria, and now Lebanon. And you see that Saudis are becoming completely unpredictable. I mean, they're doing crazy things like buying two giant islands, or they've bought them from Egypt. I mean, and they've were behind that coup d'etat in Cairo that put the military back in charge. So you see them, they're supporting, all these Syrian groups with Islamic groups, and they look at Syria as a great, great defeat for Sunni Islam, for Orthodox Muslims. And so they are lashing out at the West and us, and this goes even back to 9/11 and much before. And look, we haven't really done the Saudis any favors. I mean, we've added to their corruption, the oil money. We haven't ever pushed for a settlement with Israel, which has been a nagging issue for bin Laden and all Saudis. There's wrongs on both sides of this, but I think we have in Saudi Arabia, a country that's moving toward some sort of collapse. And the more anxious they are, the more likely they are to strike out at us or support their proxies like the Islamic State.
Well, recently, PBS Frontline did an expose on Saudi Arabia with hidden cameras, because you can't film within the kingdom. And this was done by a reporter who had previously done the same in North Korea with hidden cameras to expose what life is like in the Hermit Kingdom. And it turns out that life inside Saudi Arabia is even more repressive than North Korea, if you can believe that. And arguably, women in North Korea are treated better. It was a shocking expose of and when you say the likelihood of the country cracking up, it was made very, very clear that the young are chafing under this strictures. And a quarter of the population in this country, with fabulously rich family sitting on top of a pile of oil, a quarter of the population are living in poverty. It's extraordinary. So that seems to be where the rubber meets the road, surely, within the country itself.
Yeah, the wealth disparities, And another thing is the Arabian aquifer has dried up, so Saudi Arabia has to no longer exports wheat for a couple of years now. And this huge disparity, and they're cutting back subsidies. And most of the Saudis work in jobs that aren't real at all. They're just wealth transfers. And as that money goes away, it's impossible to predict when a revolution is going to arrive exactly. But certainly the Saudis are moving to a crisis point. And I would really be surprised if Mohammed bin Salman, the second crown prince, is able to turn this around. This is a 30-year-old man. I just can't believe a 30-year-old is a visionary to that degree to change that society. And if I had to bet, and I've written a book about this, I never gave it a timeline, that we are going to watch that country break up probably into two parts. And the royal family unseated, or at least part of them. I just don't see a way around this. Some sort of revolution there.
Well, already the young king apparently is ordering the kidnapping of dissident Saudi princes in Europe. They literally are kidnapped off the streets, and airplanes are turned around in mid-flight, and nobody in Europe is even talking about it. So that would indicate a certain level of panic within the royal family itself. But my sense is that this compact between the royal family and the Wahhabis has always been a very tenuous one. And there's an extraordinary analogy between how the Wahhabis came in 1805 and just swept in and murdered everybody and took over Mecca and Medina, the holy signs, and destroyed everything, including all vestiges of the Prophet's life and houses and grave, etc. The whole thing is kind of surreal, what they've done. But they're very similar to these Islamic State people driving around in Toyota pickups. You know, the Wahhabis came in on camels. These guys could come in on Toyota pickups if the Saudi clerics one day decided, come on in, brothers. Is that a likely scenario?
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, it was what, 1802 or 1803, I can't remember, they destroyed Karbala because the Shia, they declared apostates. And they are, of course, that's Iran as well. I mean, anybody who doesn't adhere to their narrow vision of Islam, they declare apostates. And that's even, you know, true Muslims. So, this cohesion in the sect that they control. But you're right. I mean, the point is the Saudi royal family climbed up on this tiger. I doubt that many princes are strict Wahhabis. Some are. The king is, but he's suffering dementia. The current king is a Wahhabi. And, you know, they were raiders out of the desert. And this is what they're going back to. And this narrow definition of Islam is causing problems everywhere across the Middle East. And I don't see how they back down from that, because what holds that country together is Wahhabi Islam. And if you give that up to a large degree, smart people tell me the country splits up. And, you know, as I said, between the Hijaz and the Najd. I loathe to predict what that's going to look like.
Well, just in closing then, Robert Baird, the move by the Saudi royal family to rein in the Mutawa, the religious police, and saying, you know, they can't arrest and persecute their citizens anymore arbitrarily as they've done for the longest time, that they can, you know, they have to treat their citizens with respect and dignity and call in the secular, not the secular, well, I guess by comparison, the secular authorities, call in the actual police as opposed to the religious police to deal with these endless infractions.
So, yeah, but Ian, that's just cosmetic. I mean, you've got the textbooks, you've got the mosques, you've got the whole religious establishment, and, you know, beating people in public with canes, you know, they can cut back at that. But at the end of the day, it would be just, it would be cataclysmic for the royal family to separate from the Wahhabi clerics and that strict form of Islam. I just think there would be violence, serious violence in the kingdom.
Well, but what about the Wahhabi clerics separating from the royal family? Because there's always been a rumor that they hate them.
Exactly. They could go after the royal family, dump them, and create their own Islamic republic. I mean, what they think is a pure one. And that would be equally as bad to see, you know, the world's oil reserves falling under Islamic State-like country. So I don't see any solutions out of this for anybody. We've just all gone too far. I mean, clearly, what we have to stop doing is relying on very cheap oil. I mean, don't forget the Europeans, in some sort of crisis in the Middle East, can simply withdraw their tax on gasoline, but ours is so small, it wouldn't make much difference, and we would suffer greatly. I can't be one to vote for a crisis in Saudi Arabia, but I just don't see a way out of it.
Well, Robert Baer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude. And he is now the National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, and his latest book is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the growing animus between supporters of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. He has an article at CNN, Clinton and Sanders Supporters Can't Stand Each Other. Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And you were at the Thursday night debate in Brooklyn between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. You were in the audience. And according to your article, you said that the tensions on stage, and clearly it was a combative debate, the tensions on stage were nothing compared to the tension in the crowd. And that doesn't bode well, I think, for the Democrats as they go through the last of these primaries. I got the impression from your article that you were quite shocked by what you witnessed.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of this has been evident, you know, certainly on the internet and certainly at some of the rallies where the tensions that, you know, are emerging between the supporters of the candidates are becoming greater. Obviously, you know, that we're right in the heat of the campaign and it's competitive, but we've seen this playing out already. And it was pretty striking at the actual debate to see how the two sides were responding to the candidates. I mean, it moved far beyond cheering one person versus the other. There was just clear animosity about what the other candidate, the opponent, represented to these people watching the debate, and a certain level of real anger, which reminded me of 2008 and could pose a problem if it becomes worse and if it's not handled well by the candidates.
But 2008, of course, the Hillary supporters who were disappointed, a few refused to support Obama, most did. So that's,
yeah.
This could be different, though, don't you think?
There's two kind of, you know, patterns. We have 2008, which I point out is what needs to happen for Democrats this year. And there was a lot of work at that time by the Clinton campaign after they lost to make sure, you know, that supporters didn't make some kind of decision to sit out the campaign, which is the bigger threat, obviously, than defecting to the Republican side. But there are other examples. 1968, when many supporters of Eugene McCarthy just had no interest in really mobilizing or helping with the Hubert Humphrey campaign, or 1980 when Ted Kennedy's supporters, who ran against Jimmy Carter in the primaries and lost, really didn't like the president. And, you know, even the Carter team thought, you know, their lack of enthusiasm and energy was part of the reason he couldn't mount a successful campaign to Reagan. Those are the other kinds of models that can happen. So Democrats can't take it for granted that after this is over, everything will be okay, because we've seen other scenarios play out.
So what explains this apparent suicidal tendency on the part of the liberal wing or the left wing of the Democratic Party, or the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as some prefer to call it, given those two examples where they abandoned Humphrey and in effect helped elect Nixon, and then again in 1980 when they abandoned Carter in the general for Teddy Kennedy, who was famously asked by Roger Mudd of NBC News, you know, why do you want to be president? And there was this deafening silence where Teddy Kennedy simply couldn't think of an answer. But Carter was damaged in the primary. And then a lot of these same liberal Democrats supported Anderson in the general against Carter. And Anderson, of course, was a Republican. So what explains that? I mean, there's a tendency amongst all my liberal and progressive friends is that they tend to hate somebody that's slightly to the right of them, as opposed to somebody like a Ted Cruz who's way to the right of them. And I suppose on the other side, on the Republican side, there's this the Tea Party hate the rhinos, as they call them, Republicans in name only. So why is it that people hate the person who's slightly more moderate than they are, more than the person who is far more radical and therefore more dangerous than they are?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think there is a personal element, and, you know, certainly with Jimmy Carter, there were a lot of progressives who didn't like the person. They didn't trust him. They, like many other Americans who were not on the left, just didn't find him to be a very appealing or effective leader. And I think with Hillary Clinton, there's a number of personal dynamics at work, you know, ranging from a dislike that many people seem to have of her, to certain gender dynamics that play out about her candidacy. But there's also, you know, a genuine ideological struggle that's been going on among Democrats since the 1960s, where there are some who argue that the party is, in effect, destroying itself, and that it's not simply a choice between someone more centrist and a really right-winger like a Ted Cruz, but, in fact, if the party doesn't adhere to its values and doesn't kind of, it's not enthusiastic about its traditions, it will constantly create the opportunities for Republicans to win. The argument is Republicans are more comfortable in some ways with their own ideals than Democrats are. So I think that's the belief that fuels a lot of progressive discontent with people who are more to the center within the Democratic Party. And there's this reform argument that Sanders has raised that, you know, by accepting the status quo, you don't create an even playing field. That the way campaign finance works, Republicans are going to keep doing better on key policy issues. So I think it raises the stakes of these kinds of battles, and it's part of what fuels the anger with Clinton-style politics.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Clinton and Sanders Supporters Can't Stand Each Other. And that was in response to your presence at the debate on Thursday night in Brooklyn, where within the audience itself around you, Julian Zelizer, there was enormous tension and hostility between the pro-Sanders supporters and the pro-Clinton supporters. Is the problem, though, with the Democrats in a way also to do with money, in a sense that the Republicans get their money from the oligarchs and the corporate and the business people and the Chamber of Commerce types, etc.? That's a natural fit for them. Whereas in many ways, the Democrats also, since Bill Clinton's triangulation, get their money from the same people, but they get their votes from different people. And that seems to be very clear now. For example, Bernie Sanders is running an ad saying, essentially, my people give $27 and millionaires and billionaires like millionaires like George Clooney are having these huge fundraisers where it's $353,000 to sit at the high table. So, and there were big demonstrations at George Clooney's home yesterday here in not too far from where I'm broadcasting. I think they're mostly Sanders supporters, of course. And again, the Sanders supporters weren't they weren't picketing a fundraiser for Ted Cruz, but they were picketing a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. So is that the problem that the Democrats have, is it's all about the money?
Well, it's a big problem. I mean, I don't think it's been all about the money for a lot of the Democrats who are criticized, including Hillary Clinton, who I believe on many issues is genuinely liberal. But we have this odd coalition within the Democratic Party that has formed in the last, certainly since the 1990s, few decades, where the party has aggressively courted corporate donors, and they've tried to match what the Republicans have done on the argument this is the only way to survive and to compete. But the base, the electoral base of the Democratic Party is not that world. It's very different. And in some ways, you know, Republicans have some of this tension, and they've done a better job until recently handling it. And some is finding issues, cultural issues, that have helped to bridge these gaps. But it's a fundamental tension, I think, in what post-1980s Democrats have been doing. And the second part of it comes back to, is the playing field level argument. And so the criticism of campaign finance is that because so much of the money comes from these interests, you will have a certain set of policies continue to survive. And so if you want to create policies that will help workers over business, this campaign finance system will never allow that to happen. And so if Democrats are actually serious about really core issues in their agenda, things like the minimum wage, you know, just allowing candidates to work within this campaign finance system will never allow government to achieve desired objectives. So I do think money is at the center of some of this tension.
Well, that's pretty much the stance that Bernie Sanders has taken throughout this entire campaign. In fact, on Thursday night when you were there at Brooklyn, Julian Zelizzi, Sanders' opening remarks were about getting rid of Citizens United. And until that's done, he doesn't believe that it's possible to continue with business as usual because it's inherently corrupt and has corrupted our political system. So again, you come back to money, but to me, it seems a little unfair to vilify people like George Clooney, who, I mean, he's leveling the playing field. On the other side, you've got the Koch brothers and a whole bunch of very, very wealthy people who, you know, obviously want to support Republicans because they support their interests and business interests in particular. So what explains that, that, you know, that we have a rotten system, but, you know, what's wrong with a Clooney or a Barbara Streisand or somebody like that, who do get vilified by the right? They're always going after Hollywood and Hollywood liberals, etc. Without them, the field would be completely dominated by the Koch brothers, wouldn't it?
Well, that's the Clinton argument. And so, you know, within this system we've had, there are many wealthy progressives who have played an important role, not just corporations, in funding the Democratic Party, in funding progressive movements, and in giving support for candidates and campaigns. And so, you know, the counter argument to Sanders is, you're right, no one really disagrees, but until we reach a moment where that kind of reform is possible, you still want a Democrat in the White House, you want Democrats in Congress, and you want to find donors who will help them win, that the alternative is much worse than a Democratic moderate. The alternative we're talking about is a Donald Trump or a Ted Cruz. And Some Bernie Sanders don't agree with that. And again, this is an old debate. It's not unique to 2016. We've heard this before. But I think that's exactly what the Clinton supporters are trying to say. And I'm not sure Sanders always has an answer for that. And so at this point, there is some money that some Democrats are going to think is good and can go for good causes.
So in terms of then a practical follow-on from the rhetoric, where, as you say, both sides agree that money is the problem and we should get money out of politics, but how do you do it and who's likely to do it? Wouldn't the most logical argument then be who is most likely to win and therefore change the Supreme Court? Because that's, you're never going to be able to overturn Citizens United by constitutional amendment. That's going to take decades. And if it's anything like the ERA, it's likely to fall short because there'll be a lot of power and money marshaled against it. So is that a reasonable argument then, that the only way, or at least the major first step to take, would be to change the Supreme Court?
Sure. I mean, the Supreme Court is the obvious place where these decisions are going to be made. You also want someone, you could argue, who will bring in the most Democrats into Congress, who might be more open to changing the finance system or passing legislation that will have an effect. Although there, too, you're going to still probably have a Republican House. But there is one other part of the Sanders campaign, I think, that has been really important and can offer a path forward, and that's his ability to tap into small money and to run a campaign on small donations. Many campaign finance reformers are now saying, look, we could try to restrict large donations. We can work on that. It's going to be difficult. But what's more effective in the short term is to find ways to encourage campaigns that revolve around small donations. And I do think even if Sanders loses, even once he's out of this, if that's what happens, his model of campaigning might actually be very important in actually moving the country forward, or certainly moving Democrats forward beyond the current campaign finance system. And there's places like Seattle that are now testing new methods to encourage and create incentives for small donations. So the idea is small money in the end will be the answer, and finding ways to encourage that as a countervailing force to large donations.
But in terms of the emotion that you witnessed and the animus between the Clinton and the Sanders camp, and there's a fear that this is just going to grow, because there's no question that the last debate they had was far more combative than earlier ones. And they seem to often get lost in the weeds, the two candidates, particularly when they're arguing with each other over who was the more qualified. When you compare them to Donald Trump and to Ted Cruz, who, I keep repeating this, but it's a fact that he essentially, for all intents and purposes, only won one important election, which was an off-year, odd election that was rescheduled for the middle of summer, and it depended entirely upon as few as possible people showing up, and therefore the hardcore people showed up and he got elected. Now, in effect, his next election is for President of the United States. Nobody has had a more easy and run than Ted Cruz, and arguably he's the least tested and least qualified candidate that has ever run for the President of the United States by those metrics. But nevertheless, here you have the Democrats beating each other up about who's more qualified, when on the other side you have manifestly unqualified candidates. So to my mind, that is completely absurd, and that they may be in the heat of battle, they're starting to lose sight of a lot of things. But on the psychological side, which we sort of tried to touch on a little while back, is it possible that one of the reasons why the Sanders supporters are so passionate is that essentially the left and the progressives are just used to losing in this country, whether it's, you know, having their heart broken by the assassinations of Jack Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King, et cetera, in the 60s, and then having Richard Nixon and the conservatives emerge? Is there a sense that at last we got somebody who's speaking for us?
There is. I mean, some of the tension and emotion comes from a good place. And I do think, you know, he is very direct in his belief in progressive values, Sanders. And that's incredibly appealing. And for many who feel that this has always been a losing battle, both within their party and within the nation more broadly, this is really exciting to see a candidate who's not only speaking to them, but who's also doing well, who's also showing you can win, and winning in some pretty big states. He's had a very successful campaign. So the key is not that enthusiasm or even some of the tension, shouldn't exist. I think that's part of the primary competition. But there will be a point where this has to dampen, and where it will be important, if Sanders does not win, that his supporters not only accept a Hillary Clinton nomination, but help work on that. Because in the end, if he doesn't, and if somehow you have a replay of 1980 rather than 2008, and you have someone like a Ted Cruz in office, I think the progressive agenda will be much more greatly damaged than they can even imagine. So, I think that's where those passions have to be ultimately tamed and redirected in new ways. Again, if Sanders isn't able to win, which we still don't know what's going to happen.
Well, just in closing, Julian Zelizer, I interviewed Tom Hayden, who heads a piece in The Nation, how he did support Sanders and now supports Hillary. And then, to be fair and balanced, I'm saying with tongue-in-cheek here, I followed that interview with a Sanders supporter, the economist James Galbraith. But I got so much hate mail about the interview with Tom Hayden. Why didn't you challenge him? I don't see my job as inviting people on the air to yell at them and argue with them. I'm trying to extract information, So I was shocked by the level of anger that, without recognizing that at least you're giving the guy equal time with the pro-Sanders person. So it seems to me that this is going to be tough to heal this divide just based upon this kind of anecdotal information that I have based upon the hate mail.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I've seen that and experienced it as well. So one of the questions is how representative is the online crew of Bernie Sanders compared to most Sanders supporters? And so some hope, some Democrats certainly, that it's not representative and that most Sanders supporters are not quite as angry in the end or in the long run with Hillary Clinton. It's hard to ignore that element, and many of the online writers are going to remain active, more active than others, and they can have extracted toll on the Clinton campaign. And there's also a question of where Sanders will be. Will he actually work for Clinton if he loses? But I do think that's part of the mood now that instantly you experience if you say anything that is perceived to be supportive of Hillary Clinton or you're supportive of Hillary Clinton. And that's when this kind of competition can be damaging. There needs to be a line, in my mind, that separates healthy partisan inter-party competition from a total vilification of the other candidate or their supporters, to the point you can destroy your own party in the process of trying to make it better.
Well, Julian Zelizer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include The Presidency of George W. Bush, Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an article at CNN, Clinton and Sanders Supporters Can't Stand Each Other. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the impeachment underway of Brazil's president. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Peter Hakim, who is the President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue. Previously, he was a Vice President of the Inter-American Foundation and has held teaching positions at MIT and Columbia and has served on the boards and advisory committees for the World Bank, Council on Competitiveness, Inter-American Development Bank, Foreign Affairs en Español, Partners for Democratic Change, and Human Rights Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Hakim.
Thank you very much.
And the impeachment vote is underway, and it's expected to be a knife-edge vote in Brasilia, where the lower house of Congress is voting to impeach President Dilma Rousseff. And then, of course, if the vote goes against her, then it goes to the Senate. And this has happened before, I think back in 1992 in Brazil, but the president was a hated person. Dilma Rousseff is maybe hated, but only by about half of the population. So this is a very, very divisive situation. And it looks like, but for the judiciary, everybody else is going to lose.
Well, number one is that Dilma is not highly appreciated by many people in Brazil at this time. Her disapproval rating is very, very high. Her approval rating is 10-12% of the population now. For different reasons, different sectors are opposed to her. And I think the major problem for her has been a very weak economy that lost 4% last year. It's on its route to lose another 4% this year, with people not seeing any light right now that would show that growth was possible. Poverty is increasing, services are declining, and there's, of course, this wave of corruption throughout the country. Not necessarily due to her, but she's the president, and when the economy falters and other things go wrong, presidents usually get the blame.
Well, not only is the economy in free fall, there's this public health emergency with the Zika virus that's spreading fast, and this is all casting a kind of pall of gloom over the Olympics, which are going to be held in Brazil in less than 4 months from now. So obviously this is not a good time for Brazil, but the charges that are involved here that have led to this crisis and have brought in Dilma Rousseff's predecessor, Lula da Silva, are all about the Petrobras, the big state oil company. And it has a kind of a similarity, to my mind, to what was going on in Mexico through the long rule of the Revolutionary Institutional Party that's made a comeback with the current president. But for the longest time, Pemex, the state oil company in Mexico, was kind of a piggy bank for the PRI party.
Right.
And it looks as if Petrobras was kind of a piggy bank for both Lula and da Silva's party.
Well, the issue is that it was not only a piggy bank for the PT, Lula, da Silva, Dilma's, Rousseff's party, but it was a piggy bank also for many of the parties in their extended alliance. One has to remember that in Brazil, the party of the president only had one out of seven congressmen supporting it. To govern, the ruling party needs to form these large extended coalitions, which almost invite corruption, whether it's corruption through actual transfer of funds to some members in exchange for votes, or it's earmarking financing for the constituencies, the states and municipalities of others, promises of jobs, promises of post-political career jobs. There's a whole set of arrangements that are made to sort of corral these huge coalitions of 10, 12, 15 parties to participate and support the government. And it's the government, the holder of the presidency, that really is the only one that can that has the resources to maintain this kind of coalition. So there's sort of a corruption that has pervaded Brazilian politics for a very long time. It's grown, it's ballooned, and it became just too massive to sustain itself.
So at this moment, in Brasilia, in the nation's capital, in the lower house of Congress, their deputies are voting one by one in this long televised session that's going to go on for hours, and I think about 500 of them each are given a minute or so to make a speech. So this is a bit, for Dilma Rousseff, this is going to be like water torture, you know, the slow drip, drip, drip. But my understanding is that one of the factions that's key here is the evangelical faction. And there was this charismatic woman who ran for president who didn't make it, who comes from very humble background, but is a evangelical. So what role is she playing?
Well, it's hard to sort out the different roles. Let me say that you used the term knife edge to describe how this vote is going to come out. I don't think it's going to be so knife-edged. I think that the supporters of impeachment, unless there's been some change over the last, let's say, 24 hours, really have the advantage now. They'll probably win by 30 or 40 votes. It doesn't look like there's much of an opportunity for Rousseff to remain in office. Once this gets the impeachment vote is taken and the Senate agrees by a simple majority to accept the charges and hold its own impeachment trial of Dilma, she is suspended, and that could take another couple of weeks. I don't think Marina da Silva is playing a very crucial role in this vote. I think the evangelicals have long been opposed to the PT, or most of them. Marina, at one point, was a member of the PT. She was the environment minister under Lula da Silva, and then left there and has a sort of an odd political profile, to say the least. But I don't think that she was played a major role in this process.
But the judiciary certainly did, and it does appear to be an independent judiciary, which is certainly by recent history in Brazil is in itself an accomplishment.
Oh, absolutely! This is a night and day. Brazil's 5, 6, 8 years ago, people were calling Brazil's judiciary system basically dysfunctional. There was large-scale immunity of people either with money or political power, that no one was sent to jail for corruption. But now they really have taken a leading role in the beginning to go after corruption, and suddenly there's high-level political figures that are going to jail. There's very wealthy business leaders going to jail for the corruption. But of course, that's now they're exposing it, and it becomes very, it's another factor in sort of the uncertainty about Brazil, the extent to which this corruption has tarnished virtually every part of the political order, and we shall see. But certainly, the performance of the judiciary is very welcome. They are showing an independence, an autonomy. In part, let me add, though, I mean, to sort of the subtlety is that the presidency is very weakened, the Congress is very weakened. Both of them have very low approval ratings, which gives the judiciary even greater independence than it might have if the presidency and the Congress were at all functioning well.
Well, then just let's, Peter Hakim, just go ahead. And since you've said that of the 513 members of the lower house of Congress, if they get a two-thirds vote, then the impeachment proceeds, and that is to the Senate. And that's 342 votes. And you said that they're likely to get that. And then the Senate votes just by a simple majority, 41 out of 81. Have to vote in favor of impeachment.
Right.
And then 180 days, she'd be suspended for during the hearings. And then, so that's certainly not going to be good for the country. So what happens at the end of the day here?
Well, that's, of course, the big debate, whether that's good for the country or not. Every time, without defending one side or the other, every time that it seems like she's closer to being ousted from her job, whether through a resignation or through an impeachment process, the stock market in Brazil jumps a few points. So, there's certainly, if there's as I suspect there are in the lower house, they need 350 two votes, I think, to impeach her there. They probably will get somewhere around 380 votes, I would estimate, just very roughly. And I wouldn't be surprised if it goes higher as congressmen try to find the winning side to be associated with. So by all respects, there's the majority of people want to see her out. Now, the problemsome side of that is the majority of Brazilians don't want to see the vice president in office either. They have the same low approval rating for him that they do for Dilma. They would like to see both of them impeached. So this is a very, very difficult period where most Brazilians, the big majority of the population, have lost confidence in virtually every part of their government. They want the president impeached, but they certainly would not vote for the vice president. And the next people in line are either charged with crimes or under investigation. This is a real crisis of confidence the government faces, and it's going to take an extraordinary effort politically by various, and one can only hope that the country will begin to come together at some point. But right now, this is a very, very highly tense, uncertain, and close to being chaotic situation.
Well, it looks as though when the world shows up in Brazil for the Olympics, the country is going to be leaderless. Well, we've run out of time here today, Peter Hakim, and I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Hakim, who's President Emeritus of the Inter-American Dialogue and previously was a Vice President of the Inter-American Foundation. He's taught at MIT in Columbia and has been on the boards of the World Bank Council on Competitiveness, Inter-American Development Bank, Foreign Affairs, and on Espanol and Partners for Democratic Change and Human Rights Watch. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.